So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review, man.
Right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
It is with great excitement that we say, it's review away. I'm John Pollock.
What?
I want to start things off a bit different.
It is with great excitement. It sounds like you're about to announce some type of partnership or...
Are you not excited to do the show?
Yeah, but I wouldn't say it like that.
Don't you notice we just get into these rhythms of just starting things off the exact same way. It's always same opening line.
All right. Well, maybe I can start it.
You want to notice, maybe this is not the case for you, but I find every time I go in the morning, I buy my coffee, I order my coffee every day the exact same way. It's like, hey, can I just get a blah, 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 thanks. You're like a robot.
Yeah.
You just default into order coffee mode. There's no variation of my words. It's a very robotic state of which I order.
Well, maybe it's time you changed it up.
It's a very robotic act, actually. Just lining up.
It's all up to you.
Ordering something.
It's all up to you. You don't have to do the same thing.
I don't want to do anything differently. I don't know why this
is necessarily
a bad
thing.
I'm just saying. People just complain about doing things similar.
I feel like you complaining about something, about like ordering coffee.
That's consistent.
Is a robotic thing.
No, I don't complain about ordering coffee that often.
Yeah, you do.
No, I don't.
You complain about the service at the Tim Hortons downstairs.
Because it's consistently bad. So their consistency mirrors my consistency of my complaints.
Well, I don't know how to break the cycle, John. Maybe you just have to do something really crazy, like grow your hair out.
I can't do that.
It's gone the opposite forever. Of shaving your head.
Yeah, I can't grow my hair out. How's your hot chocolate, half coffee combination?
How could you tell?
Because I know you. You ordered this last week, so now you're into your uniform ordering.
Did I order this last week?
Yes. You came up to me and Braden and you told us about this
fascinating
recommendation that the guy at Tim Hortons, he gave you great service.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it's me. Maybe I'm the problem. Maybe it's not the service.
I have a hot chocolate and a half coffee. And
what does that even taste like?
Tastes good.
Can you decipher both? Coffee and the hot chocolate
here's
coming together?
Sometimes, you know, I like a hot chocolate. I love my sweets. But sometimes a hot chocolate is a little too sweet.
Yeah. I don't like hot chocolate any longer.
Too sweet.
Oh, Jesus.
Like
that's
like
probably how like they came up with that.
Yeah, like
how's your coffee? Too sweet.
Yeah. They must have been drinking a lot of hot chocolate.
Hot chocolate coffee combinations.
Yeah. National.
I'm sure that's all the clique was drinking when they were traveling.
Definitely. But sometimes I find a coffee a little too bitter. So the combination of the two, perfection.
You're a weird man.
What? How is that weird?
It just
a very common drink.
I guess so. If this person
maybe you should try it if you're looking for more excitement in your life. Which sounds like you.
I didn't say I was looking for more excitement in my life.
Well, you were complaining. That was the insinuation. So
it's certainly not my coffee. My coffee gives me a nice jump every morning.
All right then. Good for you. I'm happy for you.
Can I rant about one more thing before we start?
Oh, yes, of course. I mean, I expected it. I set out this time for you to rant.
This is where I get everything out way. Yep. This is cheaper than therapy. I'm so tired of these damn Facebook memories that I get.
Yeah, me too.
Why?
sometimes they're kind of nice, but I mean, for me to want to share a memory, no, these are private. I don't want people to.
In fairness, you did post this photo to the world so many years ago. So now,
yeah,
it's not as private as.
But they're often embarrassing.
Yes,
you know?
Agreed.
Like, I mean, I'm sure you've written things on the internet, like for your audio, John's audio wrestling show. Would you want that all of a sudden to pop up? I don't know if any of us want things from 9 years ago to pop up for the world to see right now. I feel like everybody's, you know, constantly evolving. And I don't know. There's just not many things, and even photos.
Are you a nostalgic person, Wade? Do you look back and say, wow?
Yeah, I am personally, but I wouldn't, it's not something I would broadcast to the world. I mean, like, I might go back and like open a family photo album and be like, wow, I feel so much nostalgia, but I wouldn't broadcast it.
See, I thought about this the other day. I was in the elevator and there's this little baby that was on, like a toddler that was on the elevator with their parent. And then another woman is standing in the elevator as the mother takes her little child off, and the other woman is waving to the little toddler and then leaves and then goes to me, oh, to be that young again, not a care in the world, and just to be so happy. And I was like, I guess. And I'm like thinking, I wouldn't want to be a toddler all over again. I wouldn't want to go back 10 years ago. I wouldn't want to go back. Why would you want to go back in time?
Would you want to go back 5 years ago?
No.
Would you want to go back 10 days ago?
No. I wouldn't want to negate anything I've done since then. Yeah, that's what you would do. To go back 2 years, that would mean you've done nothing in 2 years that is worth living for to continue forward.
I'm with you, man. I mean, because I think the thought of,
you know. The hope is that you're moving forward in some weird metaphysical way.
The thought of going back in time is you know. Is like, oh, I can redo this, or maybe I can experience what life was like again without all the stresses of adulthood. But that means you only have the stress to look forward to, which I don't want. I want the stress behind me. You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to go through high school again. I don't want to go through university again. I don't want to have to do homework for the rest of my life outside of watching pro wrestling. You know what I mean?
That's the closest we have to homework
now.
The
only homework I have.
And writing fighter notes.
And like, we're doing exams and all that shit. I'm so happy to be done with the whole schooling system. I wouldn't want to go back to being 6 years old and having to look
forward like any
to all
time
that.
In your life. I mean, you can look back fondly on memories. That's great. I enjoyed my teenage years, but to go back at that point, it's like you watch a great movie. I will always remember that great movie. I don't need to rewatch it. I'm not going to have the same experience redoing something.
But I mean, if you're asking me if I want to go back and relive select moments, then perhaps, yeah. Like, I would love to go back to 1993 to relive Joe Carter's home run at like 9 years old. I think that would be a lot of fun.
Or do you wish that you could be a 31-year-old to truly appreciate that moment in 1993 that maybe an 8-year-old you wouldn't?
Sure, that would be really nice too. But I think there's something about experiencing it as a child. Just like watching wrestling as a child is probably a different experience than watching as an adult. But with that said, are there any like highlights of your career that you ever go back to rewatch? You know, like are there select interviews that you think about, oh, that was a great interview. I'm going to go back and listen to it again.
I have memories of certain things, but no, I don't go back and watch or listen to anything.
So I guess my question is, do you think Shinsuke Nakamura would ever go back to 2003 matches of his?
He does not seem like a guy that would ever get to the point of signing up for the WWE Network with his credit card to go back and watch himself.
Well, he would watch New Japan World, I'm sure.
I don't know if he's necessarily the streaming type. He's a very interesting individual.
Yeah, I don't know.
You need to follow this guy. The craziest thing last week that I saw, it was on Friday. And it was, I mean, not anything weird. I mean, it was just a factual tweet from Shinsuke Nakamura. I will be at the NXT Concord show tonight at the Municipal Auditorium, or I'm paraphrasing it. And it was just the weirdest tweet to read that even 6 months ago, that you would never anticipate seeing Shinsuke Nakamura promoting his NXT appearance tonight in Concord, wherever, North Carolina, on a Friday night. I mean, what a weird world we are in.
That is pretty bizarre.
I mean, where a year from now, I mean, who will be populating this NXT brand?
If I had to guess right now.
If any talent is out there that is, you know, a you know, has got a major following, hell, a modicum of a following. I think the worst thing you could do in this current environment is sign a long-term deal with anyone because you don't know where the wind is going to blow next. A year ago, the idea that Shinsuke Nakamura would be in the middle of the WWE, that they would be pursuing so many names, that Zack Sabre Jr. is going to work a WWE show later this year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it is just insanity when you think about it. And to sign off to some, I think the Young Bucks were so smart. They signed a 1-year deal with ROH. They had a very nice deal that they signed with them, still allowed them to do PWG. And when that deal expires at the end of this year, anyone with a IQ is going to be after these guys, and they're going to up their demand that much more rather than sign away for the next 3 years, for instance, and lock themselves down. There's some security in that decision, but I think they're taking a very, very manageable risk by being free agents later this year, and we'll have many, many options on the table.
Yes.
Shinsuke Nakamura, a man who had the option on the table earlier this year, and he dove headfirst into life in North America. Many people watching him, most likely, but not admittedly, for the first time against Sami Zayn at TakeOver. Probably, I hope I never, ever come across like one of those people that is, yeah, match was good. Should have seen him 5 years ago when he was really good. I hope I never have that tone. And Wei, you slap me if I ever sound like that. I can't stand that attitude when it's people who are just, yeah, maybe they're watching them for the first time.
Yeah.
You can appreciate someone and not know their entire backstory and everything about them.
Yeah, what are you, an NXT noob?
Oh, I hate that term so much. That's still a term, like tough noob. That would require you've been watching MMA and UFC for 11 years. That's a long time.
Yeah.
It's a long time. Mm-hmm. I don't understand this. It's like, oh, look at what my, card says.
You know who a lot of tough noobs are? MMA fighters that are currently in the UFC who have probably never seen MMA until they started watching The Ultimate Fighter.
Of course. Sage Northcutt.
Oh, yeah. What a tough noob.
Dude, I guarantee you he wasn't watching Tough One.
Was John Jones watching in 2000?
He was Ultimate Fighter would be 2005, so he was...
Yeah, I know what I'm saying. Was John Jones
in 2000?
Prior to that?
Probably not. No, probably not. Maybe Shinsuke Nakamura was...
he definitely was. He's not a tough noob.
I'm sure he was watching The Ultimate Fighter.
Well...
Maybe when he was over in CMLL.
Like, yeah, he's watching something.
Seeing the rise of Diego Sanchez, seeing some of that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to discuss here. We picked out select matches here that we're going to go through involving the career of Shinsuke Nakamura. Some just purely as matches were outstanding to watch. Others more historical significance than maybe the actual match in and of itself.
And the full list, of course, is available at lawradio.proboards.com.
Yeah, we'll keep that list up if you want to go back and watch. I didn't want to overload it with stuff from New Japan World and put matches that are behind a paywall. We do have two New Japan World matches on this, but the others are just out there through perfectly open means in the case of Revolution Pro posting the Zack Sabre Jr. match and others that just happen to be there. And I don't really have much of a guilty conscience about if it's on such a prominent file sharing site.
I don't know if Ultimate Crush is going to be submitting any legal lawsuits.
No, they did pretty well that night. That was a pretty big card in 2002 I'm sure they reaped the benefits of.
Let's talk about it.
Yes, we are. We'll chat about Ultimate Crush. I guess, what do you want to discuss first?
I mean, I thought we would do this thing almost chronologically.
Okay, well then we start off. Ultimate Crush.
The MMA bout.
Yes, this was Shinsuke Nakamura and Jan the Giant Norche.
Yeah.
Tell me about Jan Norche, Wei, just from watching this guy. I mean, pretty much a former boxer, kickboxer, who's moving over.
He's a name I've heard of, just in K1. And just basically, you see the match, you see the size of the two of them, and you quickly realize there are no weight limits in this particular MMA bout, which we will be talking about. And I wonder if a lot of people are even aware that Shinsuke Nakamura had a MMA career. And how exactly in the timeline of this, did this coincide with his pro wrestling, or did he focus on one rather than the other first?
Well, Nakamura, just to go over a bit of his background here. I mean, this was a guy that, I mean, had a legitimate background. He was a freestyle wrestler in college. He placed fourth in the collegiate nationals at 97 kilograms. So, I mean, he had that background, and this was at the time when he started off in the New Japan Dojo back in 2002. And this was at the time when New Japan was just falling in love. This was the Inoki influence, and so much of the Pride influence and mixed martial arts as a whole was just overtaking New Japan's booking. And there would be a giant detriment to the product as a result of this. And in a weird way, Shinsuke Nakamura was somebody that was able to navigate this philosophy at the time where they were throwing guys in like Yuji Nagata, famously, and other guys into legitimate fights that just – it was awful to their business, and it got to be way too much. But Shinsuke Nakamura was someone that they introduced, and he was able to go in, and his first fight was with Daniel Gracie. He debuted for New Japan in August of 2002, and then he faced Daniel Gracie at the Inoki Bombaye show on New Year's Eve 2002. And even though he lost to Gracie
– Sorry. New Year's Eve 2002, which is after his New Japan.
Yeah. His pro debut was August of 2002.
This was December 31st, 2002.
Correct.
Got it.
So he was submitted by Daniel Gracie but put up a good showing against Daniel Gracie, and being – essentially a young boy at the time, the fact that he was able to hang with Gracie for a bit, this was not viewed as some detrimental loss.
I'm really curious to know how he would have split his pro wrestling and mixed martial arts training at the time, because I mean, we've seen with guys like King Mo and Rampage, you know, who have said that it's almost nearly impossible to be doing both at the same time.
Well, I think it was unique to the sense that the New Japan Dojo, I think a lot of the training as well, I mean, there was a lot of crossover principles that, I mean, this guy was able to stay sharp. And I mean, that wrestling pedigree he had, that wasn't just going to disappear on him. And that was certainly his strength in these fights. So, Jan Norche was his second fight. And that was May of 2003 at this very ambitious card that New Japan was promoting called Ultimate Crush, which was going to be half worked matches and half legitimate fights, and presented as such. And that resulted in a lot of criticism of the show because they were being so open about the fact it wasn't like New Japan promoted their Tokyo Dome every year and said, hey, worked matches coming up at the Tokyo Dome. It was just New Japan Pro Wrestling. And with Ultimate Crush, they put that line in the sand.
Yeah.
And it was risky because how are these two audiences going to mix? Are people going to buy tickets to go see half worked matches and half legitimate matches? And the answer was yes. This was a real big success, and they did a huge number at the Tokyo Dome for this show back in 2003. And Nakamura and Norche, well, not the main event by any stretch.
What was the main event? Do you know?
The main event on that card, I would have to
– does it say right there, actually, if you go back?
Let me look at this.
I'm curious now.
I probably have the whole card. This is just weird. Here we have the whole card on Sure Dog. Which would have probably pro. Oh, it's just got the
okay.
The legitimate fights: Kazuyuki Fujita and Manabu Nakanishi. Just think about that. That was only 13 years ago, and Manabu Nakanishi, Josh Barnett, Jimmy Ambrose, which was, of course, this was when Josh Barnett was doing New Japan at the time. Nakamura and Jan Norche, Tsuyoshi Kosaka and Sumiya Bizarre Dogosurin, and then Lyoto Machida. I believe that was his debut as well, his first MMA fight. And this was
There's a trivia note for you.
Yes, this was his first fight ever against Kengo Watanabe. And this was when Lyoto Machida was very much the protege of Antonio Inoki.
Right.
He had found him in Brazil and was going to bring this guy up to be the next big thing and be Inoki's successor.
And all these guys used to stay, like Nakamura and Machida, they all used to train at the dojo, right?
Yeah, he was there. This would have been before Nakamura went over to the LA Dojo and was rooming with Brian Danielson, but that was when Machida would also be working out of the LA Dojo. Some very interesting names when you go back there to the New Japan LA Dojo there that they had. You could even see a very young Lyoto Machida at ringside during this fight with Norche. So Norche was brought in. This guy was hardly a very skilled mixed martial artist. I mean, it had a pretty paltry record. Not a big threat against Nakamura, but nonetheless, this guy, at least according to the tale of the tape here, Norche was 310.9 pounds. Nakamura was 229.3. So, not exactly, not even near the heavyweight weight limit was the giant, Jan Norche. And Norche, 8 inches taller here as well, at least listed as such. Yeah. And Norche came out with this zebra poncho and was 1-2 at this point with quick submission losses to Gary Goodridge. Think about that. He was submitted by Gary Goodridge in 2001 and Yoshihisu Yamamoto back in December at Pride 18. And his one win was over Tadeo Yasuda. So some quite the resume here for Norche. So the fight began and it started very similar to where we would see Nakamura when he would take on Sakuraba later at the Tokyo Dome, just shooting for takedowns here. And that was largely Nakamura's game, was takedown. He had a very good takedown game.
Yeah, and that was something that immediately stood out to me. Great low singles. A move that he still employs in his current pro wrestling moveset, I see from time to time. But here he's clearly able to execute it in a legit fight against this giant. And I thought he did that aspect very well. Didn't really get to see any of his stand-up, though, unfortunately.
No, I think it would be that's limited.
Yeah. And against the K1 kickboxer as limit, even if it was Jan Norche, probably the smart move.
Yeah, Nakamura, he was on bottom and then reversed in the corner. And this crowd went nuts here as he got on top and then was just working in half guard, landed some hammer fists and elbows. And crowd was reacting huge to Nakamura throwing knees. I mean, he was very much – I mean, they had seen a lot of pro wrestlers just be sacrificed here in shoot situations. And Nakamura represented someone that – I mean, even against someone limited like Norche, the visual was very – impressive.
Yeah.
And here was a guy that, man, this guy can hang with some people. Mm-hmm. They'd seen him against Daniel Gracie, and here he is, and he's winning this round against Norche.
I was very impressed at how Nakamura was able to control him on top, and basically Norche had no answer from the bottom for these hammer punches, hammer fists. He just kind of ate everything.
So the round ended, and this also featured near the end, this like ankle pick that Nakamura just took him down with such ease. This was like Randy Couture and James Toney level of ease, taking down this gassed Norche, who I would say had about 60 seconds in this fight before he was done.
It also really stood out to me seeing all the knees from the bottom onto a downed opponent. They were just widely abundant, both from Nakamura and from Jan Norche here. Perhaps a precursor to the Bomae.
So the round ended, Nakamura winning the first round. I mean, this was a pretty easy 10-9. And these were five-minute rounds. These weren't the Pride rules. Second round, just an easy single leg for Nakamura. He's delivering punches and knees, goes to knee on belly, knees to the head. They're separated in the corner and get reset in the middle. Nakamura mounts him, is delivering strikes. Now, if you simply read the result, it's he wins by guillotine choke.
No.
That would be incorrect. No. I mean, I would even say a forearm choke sounds a little liberal to how this was. I mean, this was at best pressure on the jaw, and this dude just was gassed and done.
Yeah.
I mean, this was, yes, a tap. This to me was almost – it was a nonverbal submission because he was just done.
Yeah, I agree. It didn't look like anything was in, certainly not long enough for it to be a choke. It just looked like Jan Norche bitched out.
And Nakamura, this was a win for him against a really a big guy size-wise. Mm-hmm. And someone that at least gave, I think, the pro wrestling side – he was able to circumvent what was an awful treatment of the next generation of talent. I mean, thankfully, Tanahashi was kept away from this. But Nakamura was somebody that, because of his background, was moved over here and was never put in a situation where he was damaged. I mean, he would have fights where he was – roughed up significantly that we'll get into. But I mean, he was somebody that kind of escaped this where others, Yuji Nagata, I mean, it took a long time for him to recover from the fights he was put in.
Yeah. It was cool, to see Nakamura, you know, in this MMA fight and do well against this, heavyweight K1 kickboxer. Like I said, I was impressed with some of his wrestling and I thought he maintained his top control pretty well. It's surprising though, because so many pro wrestlers, I think, with any type of MMA background, it really is a big part of their pro wrestling character. But with somebody like Shinsuke Nakamura, it's nothing you ever hear about to this day, at least presently. It really has no bearing on what his character is today.
So I want to go from here into his next prominent fight. I mean, he did a jungle fight show in September of 2003, which also featured Lyoto Machida and Stephen Bonner on that card. I have never seen that jungle fight card. I mean,
I think we had it.
Did we?
Yeah.
I've never seen the fight Nakamura had on this one. I mean, some people have raised their eyebrows at that particular quote-unquote fight.
Okay.
But his next big fight was Alexei Ignashev, who was an outstanding kickboxer. This happened on New Year's Eve 2003 on the K1 Dynamite card, which featured Bob Sapp and Aki Bono, which was a gigantic success in the country of Japan. But prior to that, Shinsuke Nakamura, out of nowhere, defeated Hiroyoshi Tenzan in December of 2003, becoming the youngest IWGP champion in their history. And it was very surprising because Tenzan had been groomed. He beat Takayama only a month prior in November, and then Nakamura beats him. So they were going all in with Nakamura at this point, and then they put him into the fight against Alexei Ignashev, who, again, a night and day compared to Jan Norche. This was a much more dangerous fight for Nakamura, who is now your IWGP champion. This wasn't just your young lion that was being put into a fight. This was now your champion. So the fight with Ignashev, it featured Nakamura with tons of takedowns in this particular fight, but he got rocked so badly with this knee. And then he got up and the ref stopped the fight, and it was very much debated if this should be, if this was a early stoppage or not. However, the damage kind of tells the story. He broke his nose and both orbital bones. And it ended up being, it was a win that night for Ignashev, but then a few days later at the Tokyo Dome, they came out and announced it was a no contest. Which is, again, we're not under any commissions, that just the idea that an early stoppage and then a few days later, they just say, ah, it's a no contest. Probably wouldn't fly here, but nonetheless, that's what it's ruled as. But Nakamura, just days later, had to defend the IWGP title and headline the Tokyo Dome with Yoshihiro Takayama with two broken orbital bones and a broken nose. This was 5 days after this fight with Ignashev.
This is ridiculous.
So when you saw the close-ups, and that's why I picked this Takayama fight, it was his first Tokyo Dome main event. It was to unify the IWGP and NWF championships, which was a regional title that Antonio Inoki won in the States and New Japan used as their major title from 1973 to 1981. They brought it back, put it on Takayama, and then this was their unification match at the Dome Show in 2004. But Nakamura going through with this match, insanity.
In particular, this type of match. I had no idea that was the backstory prior to watching this match. This match itself was very, very brutal.
Yeah, when you put into context the shape he was in. I mean, you see the close-ups where, if you don't know any better, you think it's like eyeliner or something he's got on. But he's dealing with a broken nose and orbital bone fractures.
Yikes.
This guy belonged nowhere near a wrestling ring and would have to take a lot of time off afterwards. But they had to go ahead. This was the main event of the Dome Show in 2004. And this card went head to head with Pride and Zero One's first Hustle event, which featured Bill Goldberg, Dusty Rhodes on the show, Mark Coleman.
Cool.
And called by Mauro Ranallo and Boss Rutan. They went head to head with this Tokyo Dome show.
There you go.
And there was a takedown by Nakamura. He was working for a heel hook and ankle lock almost instantly. There were a number of grappling transitions and then a kick to the face of Nakamura, and the crowd, which they all knew the context, they just winced in pain here at this kick to the face, and they showed the replay in slow motion. This was fucked, man.
Would they have acknowledged it like widely on air that, hey, this guy just had an MMA fight against this guy 5 days ago?
I'm sure it was a huge part of the broadcast, but it was like it didn't even need to be like that was such a big show.
Yeah.
This was a cultural event, this K1 show.
Right.
And so many people saw that fight that it's just everybody would have been aware of the damage he took against Ignashev. A lot of grappling transitions. Nakamura struggles and then hit a released German dealing with the much bigger opponent in Takayama. And, of course, the big German was Takayama's big spot. There's big boots that send Nakamura to the floor. Knees and strikes to the head are delivered on the floor. And then they have this striking exchange in the ring. And Nakamura goes down from a right hand. And then there's elbows delivered to the eye twice by Takayama. A big knee to the face. He stands on top of Nakamura for a two count. It's all Takayama and telling the underdog story of this handicapped opponent, essentially, in Shinsuke Nakamura, who comes back with a triangle. Takayama tries to slam him out. Nakamura transitions to an armbar, and then Takayama's on top for a two count, and then a big knee is delivered to the chest of Nakamura. Crowd is very into the match at this point. Nakamura takes the suplex, fires back, stands up to Takayama, and tries to take these kicks to the face. This is where you can see Machida at ringside. And Takayama goes for the Everest German suplex. Nakamura kicks out into a Kimura, which comes out of nowhere. And then Takayama taps to the Kimura at 13:55. And Nakamura cuts this promo afterwards with Masahiro Chono and Yuji Nagata coming in the ring to celebrate with him. And the underdog gets this big win after a lot of the audience thought he might have been robbed of this fight with Ignashev a few days prior. Again, this guy, that fight probably should have been stopped given the damage he took. But nonetheless, this was Nakamura's kind of redemption, getting this big submission over the monster in Takayama and becoming IWGP NWF champion.
This was a very fun, very brutal match. And knowing now the context with which it took place, I think it probably would have been far more dramatic if I knew that fact going into it. Takayama just played such a crazy, devastating monster. And all of those knees, all of those punches, they looked really brutal, even in a pro wrestling context. So, you know, the win, the Kimura win just really kind of came out of nowhere. It was really Takayama for like 99% of this match. And that Kimura coming out of nowhere, I initially thought maybe they should have fought for it a little bit longer to just kind of let that comeback really settle in. But I think knowing the context with which MMA was presented also on at the time with in New Japan, it made it seem a little bit more legitimate to just kind of have a flash submission victory out of nowhere.
And they would do the rematch with Nakamura and Ignashev later that May at the K1 Roman X event. And in that fight, that was Nakamura submitting Ignashev. And that would be Nakamura's last MMA fight.
He's had actually, you know, relatively successful, very successful. His record is what, 3-1-1?
Oh yeah, he'd easily be in the UFC by now if this were if this were 13 years later.
But
at least
on
Ultimate Fighter,
it's actually very impressive. And again,
he has enough fights, by the way, on his record that he could do a tough tryout
for sure. And like I said, you know, not a fact that gets stated anymore about the guy. It's you know, for many people, I'm sure, a major selling point of their pro wrestling kind of pedigree. But for somebody like Nakamura, it's not even mentioned at all.
Yeah, and that would be – I mean, they kind of – I think he got enough out of those fights that they weren't going to push things further. This was, of course, then Nakamura would go he'd later form a team with Hiroshi Tanahashi. He would do his first excursion going to Mexico, which is where he developed a lot of the present-day Shinsuke Nakamura character.
Yeah, something we also never really mentioned is his look and appearance in some of these early matches. They really were just he was almost a completely different person. Different haircut, of course. Different just mannerisms. He didn't walk to the ring the same way. Obviously, didn't have the same outfits that he did. Didn't have the same moves. Didn't have the bomae. Didn't have really anything. He really came across more like a generic wrestler, in my opinion.
He was very much a MMA fighter being converted into New Japan, which was so much of the thinking at the time in how New Japan was being booked. And this was a pretty awful time period in New Japan in the mid-2000s. And that takes us to our next match, which was January the 4th of 2006. So we skipped 2 years at this point, with Brock Lesnar, who was the IWGP champion at this time, coming in the fall of 2005, instantly winning the IWGP title and then defending against Nakamura. A match that, I mean, if you're had just been introduced to Nakamura, you probably had no clue this match occurred. And more importantly, what the match actually was. So kind of certainly not a great advance for this Tokyo Dome this year. This was when Riki Choshu was booking at this point. Heavy papering for this event. Lesnar sporting his red and white trunks and boots.
Look good.
But very much presented similar to
how he is today.
Yeah, like this legitimate tough guy that is coming in as almost an attraction, that it is your IWGP champion.
Destroying everybody.
Yeah, essentially. So the match starts. Lesnar drops him right away. Shoulder blocks in the corner. I mean, this was very much Brock Lesnar create a wrestler mode style of match, I felt. There was an overhead suplex to Nakamura. Crucifix got blocked with a Samoan drop, and Nakamura rolls to the floor, just dealing with the power game of Lesnar. Nakamura connected with a head kick to Lesnar on the side of the apron, and then a suicide dive takes Lesnar down on the floor, but then Nakamura shoved back first into the steel post, and Lesnar would work over the back. Lesnar missed with an elbow drop. Nakamura went for a rear naked choke, running him into the corner to get off of his back, and then knees from Lesnar delivered to the body. Nakamura gets an armbar into the ropes, the spot that you're most associated now with Minoru Suzuki doing. Then he snaps Lesnar on the top rope, hits a missile dropkick, German suplex for the largest reaction to the match, and then a flying armbar is executed by Nakamura. He gets slammed by Lesnar, a lariat, and then Lesnar hits the Verdict, which was the renamed F5 due to his legal issues with the WWE, who was very much trying to stop him from ever working with New Japan before they ultimately had to settle. And Lesnar wins this match in 9 minutes, and I thought a really underwhelming match.
Relatively brief, you know, and really didn't feel like a main event. And I don't know if it was supposed to be, like, meaning I didn't know if it was supposed to really stand out. It just kind of played out like a pretty Brock Lesnar sort of a squash match.
Like, Brock Lesnar for... I mean, all the gifts this guy has, I mean, and you look back at his career, his New Japan run is not one that will ever be a shining moment on his in-ring, because this was a very subdued Brock Lesnar, and you would think him in Japan would be, I mean, here was a guy that had not worked since he left the WWE. You would think, you know, just select matches, the travel is what it is, but then he gets breaks. You would think, hey, he just gets to go there, work with super talented guys, but... to me, it was just not a great fit at all for him. And I would guarantee you, if these two were to be rematched in the WWE on a big show, it would be night and day from this, because this was nothing special to me. And I more or less picked this match just to look back at where this was versus what expectation level would be now if they were to have a big match in the WWE. Then we go to 2011, and a lot happened with Nakamura. After the loss to Brock Lesnar, there would be the story that he would go and train with Lesnar. He would go back to CMLL, and this is where he developed so much of the character, and he evolved significantly during this time period. He would eventually form Chaos in 2009 that he would be associated with right up until his departure from New Japan.
What led to the change in character? Was like what made him decide to, you know, get a makeover and completely change his style?
But they use this loss really to explain his absence and having to get bigger, go to Mexico, come back with a different move set, different look. So much of his character changed, and he experimented with a lot of it in Mexico and then transitioned it back to New Japan at a time when they kind of got out of this mentality of using all these fighters and what that mid-2000 period I thought was very much plagued by. And Nakamura was able to shine with the class that was rising up in the late 2000s and into this present decade.
And in this time, was this when he started the whole King of Strong style thing?
Yeah, this I think is where you can truly look at the present day Shinsuke Nakamura and the building blocks of it from that time period. So we do fast forward quite a few years here to 2011. This was the finals of the G1 that year with Nakamura and Tetsuya Naito, who was somebody that, of course, had the No Limit team with Yujiro. And I mean, it's timely that we're doing this because this past weekend was Naito's big IWGP title win, where he rose to the level that they kind of expected to get Naito to years and years ago. And this was the finals this year. I think most anticipated this would be a Nakamura win. I don't think most going into the G1 that year anticipated Naito surprising anyone. But this was, I thought, an incredible match. Nakamura had beat Minoru Suzuki to win his block, while Naito defeated Hiroshi Tanahashi to win his block. This took place in Sumo Hall. Started off with Nakamura attempting Kimuras in the early going and just slowly building the match up. And this was an extremely hot crowd. Naito hit the springboard drop kick and the crowd was behind Naito. He hit a seated drop kick to the knee off of Nakamura and then a missile drop kick to the knee, continued working it over for Nakamura and attacking the left knee with submissions.
The idea, I'm sure, was to negate the Bomae, which he had debuted as part of this new gimmick.
Yes. And this was Nakamura was very good, you know, with like tournaments or whatnot of introducing these new moves that, that we would see along the way. And Nakamura draped him on the top, hit a running right knee to the ribs, not using the left knee. And I thought it's like, oh, how smart and yet basic, just using the right knee. And then he just put him on the canvas and started driving both knees into his ribs. I was like, well, then there's that as well. Nakamura then suplexed Naito off the top with this inverted superplex, went for the Bomae, and Naito blocked. There was a flying shoulder tackle, dragon suplex for a kick out, and then into a roll up for a two count. Then Naito missed with the Stardust Press. Nakamura then went for the Bomae to the back of the head. The crowd is going insane by this point. And then from there, Naito had this awesome cradle for a near fall. Another one by Naito. Nakamura gets up, hits an Ushigaroshi with a wrist grab for a near fall. Crowd is at the edge of their seats. Then he hits the Bomae, winning the match in 20 minutes, 20 seconds. I thought that this match, it went the perfect length of time. This crowd just increased in intensity as the match wore on. Great utilization of near falls. I thought both looked outstanding, and Nakamura would win the match and thus get a future IWGP title match the following month against then-champion Hiroshi Tanahashi. I love this match.
Yeah, this match was great. I thought the comebacks and the false finishes were just so awesome in this. Both men just looked so good. But I was actually more impressed with Naito here than Nakamura. But
this was probably his biggest singles match to date.
Mm-hmm. I thought that their timing of their moves were perfect. The pacing of the match was impeccable. I thought it was technical when it needed to be and aggressive when it needed to be. So really, really a perfect wrestling match.
This was also interesting. Just this week to go back and watch with Naito that you see him here in the finals of the G1. And then the following year, he'd end up tearing his ACL in the G1 and kept working with it till October. So he took this, this time off. They did the breakup with No Limit and Yujiro getting the credit for taking him out in 2012, returned, for the G1 and won the whole tournament in 2013. And they were going to go full out with this guy. He would end up getting the title match at the Tokyo Dome where he wouldn't headline the show. And the crowd largely just rejected him in this top babyface role. They just didn't see him at that level. Hmm. And for a while, especially in 2014 into 2015, you were just wondering, is Naito going to just fall into this gatekeeper role? Was he ever going to make it to the top level? And then you got the whole faction with Los Ingobernables, which again, he had to go to Mexico to refine his character and came back with it. And to me, he was outstanding in the G1 last year. And it peaked this past weekend. Coming back, winning the title from Okada, he felt ready for the title. He felt like the top star in the company. And here was essentially close to a five-year project with Naito and getting him to the spot that he's at now. So it was really, really cool to go and watch this all the way back to the G1. It would be appreciated if you could turn off alarms and stuff. It really distracts everybody.
My fault today.
I was just joking about my own past issues. So there you go. An awesome match. If you have New Japan World, why not?
Yeah.
Go back and watch this.
It's worth it. Worth your $10 or however much it is.
So from there, we go to 2013 and New Japan introduced the Intercontinental title largely because of the signing of MVP and to give a title that they could hopefully, the thought was that they could have tours in North America and have a title with MVP. The touring never took off. They did one tour of the Northeast that did awful and they never went back to it. They would piggyback with ROH, which has been a much better way to do things in the U.S. But the Intercontinental title really didn't – it wasn't MVP's title, even though it was largely created for him. It was Nakamura who created this thing and made this a – this title was 1B to the IWGP heavyweight title being 1A.
Was there no secondary title prior to this?
No, not at this point. I mean, they had introduced titles like we had the NWF title for a time that was later absorbed. But this was introduced very much at a secondary level. And it was Nakamura that took it to be a title you could main event shows on its own with, which to me, it should be the goal of any title. I would never want to have titles in such a tiered system where it's like, okay, the mid-carders fight for this title. They took the idea that this can be a main event title as well. So in October of 2012, it was at the end of the G1 that New Japan brought back Katsuyori Shibata, and he came back with Kazushi Sakuraba. And this was viewed very much at the time as polarizing in that you had got away from all these fighters and that kind of mentality. New Japan was doing very well now. You could see a light at the end of the tunnel after all those years. So some people were negative the way Shibata had left the company years earlier. So you brought them back as the outsiders. And Sakuraba, his first big match was here at the Tokyo Dome on January the 4th, 2013, challenging Nakamura for the Intercontinental title. Now, myself, I was stoked to see Shibata back because of all the great matches. Sakuraba, I was like, this guy's going to be in and out in 6 months. And I was not looking forward to this match. I just didn't envision it being anything special because of the just how limited Sakuraba was. Mm-hmm. I couldn't have been more wrong.
And he hadn't had a wrestling match prior to this.
Well, he had worked some smaller matches. I think he did the King of Pro Wrestling show in October. But this was his first big match since coming in at that point in time. So they had this great video at the start where they showed photos of Sakuraba's fights with Mirko Krokop, the 90-minute fight with Hoist Gracie in 2000. And then they brought out Stan Hansen, guest on The Law this Sunday night, just to announce that in 3.5 years, I'll be on The Law Sunday night at 11 p.m. Eastern time at liveaudiowrestling.com. I think that's what the translation was. Mm-hmm. And he's all in black. He holds up the Intercontinental title and gives it a level of prestige, this title that here's Stan Hansen that, I mean, largely had been – affiliated. I mean, after leaving New Japan, he was exclusively with All Japan for so long for the majority of his tenure in Japan. So being here in New Japan gave the title a lot of legitimacy, having someone as respected as Stan Hansen putting this title over. So the match starts and it's very much done. I mean, this was very similar to the start of the Yen Norche fight with Nakamura shooting in, Sakuraba would sprawl. And then Sakuraba got a takedown and would be playing in Nakamura's guard, moved to half guard. Very subdued start to the match.
It was very reminiscent of Nakamura's earlier matches in pro wrestling that we looked at here that were very faux MMA influenced. Shoot style.
Yeah. They broke in the corner and Nakamura slapped him and the crowd reacted big to this level of disrespect that Nakamura was showing his counterpart.
Yes.
Then Sakuraba unloads on him with palm strikes. They start exchanging. Nakamura attacks him with knees to the body and then a running foot stomp Sakuraba goes for. Sakuraba then goes for a choke. Back into the corner, we get the vibration kick. Sakuraba then is draped on the top and the running knee misses by Nakamura. Sakuraba then unloads with strikes in the corner, hits a German suplex, and Nakamura pops up and runs at him into this hard-ass knee, which was the big spot of the entire match. And Nakamura goes down, and I guarantee you he was very much rocked by this knee for the
it looked like it,
sacrificing his skull for the art of this match.
Yeah, we actually saw the same spot in the Takayama match earlier on.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's something that he's probably done a number of times where he goes for that low single but just gets popped right with the knee. But this time, probably the best that it's ever looked, added a whole nother layer to the match.
I mean, if you're going to risk CTE in the future, I guess you would want to do it for a major show at the Tokyo Dome, right?
You would think so, but I think in all of these matches, the guy has risked CTE quite a bit.
Sakuraba mounts him. He's got Nakamura gift-wrapped and then goes for a triangle. Nakamura escapes. And the crowd is very, like, from that knee onwards, the crowd is just reacting to everything very strongly.
The drama is definitely high.
Yeah. I mean, the timing was really well done here. Nakamura escapes the triangle and lands a bomae, goes for a second one, and this time he misses, and Sakuraba applies a rolling armbar, and then he gets swept by Nakamura from the bottom. Sakuraba then goes for the Kimura, and you can hear the announcers bring up the Henzo Gracie fight, which is where Henzo Gracie, during their pride fight, would not tap and ended up having his arm broken by Sakuraba, and that was a huge win for Sakuraba. I would, you know, second to the Hoist Gracie win was the Henzo Gracie win because of the nature of the broken arm. So Nakamura, to get out, lifts him onto his shoulders and hits the landslide, which is a DVD into a Michinoku driver.
And the Kimura is actually a perfect placement to turn into a fireman's carry.
Yeah. Like, next time you have me in this,
fireman's carry,
I'm going to totally landslide.
Landslide.
That's how you get out of this. Sakuraba rolls back to a Kimura, and Nakamura is screaming. Nakamura uses knees from the bottom. Sakuraba transitions to an armbar on the opposite arm, and Nakamura breaks free of that and hits a bomae, then hits another running straight at him and pins him at 10 minutes and 8 seconds. And Sakuraba is, he believes it was an early stoppage. He's holding up two fingers, thinking it was a two count.
Mm-hmm.
And Stan Hansen presents the title and shakes Nakamura's hand. An awesome, awesome match. It was a match of the year contender. So different from anything else. And that Tokyo Dome show that year in 2013 was a phenomenal show.
Yeah, this was my match of the year for that year, and it was my first exposure to Nakamura, and I think I really liked this match at the time because I was just also really getting into jiu-jitsu, so I think a lot of the transitions were really appealing to me just to show off the beauty of submissions and how you can flow from one to another. To me, this was like a really perfect combination of the legitimacy of modern fighting movesets that, you know, are very MMA influenced, but with the pacing and the theatrics of pro wrestling. The first portion of this match were really just all submissions, and I thought done really well. I don't know how well Sakuraba's been doing in his current New Japan run as a pro wrestler, but if there's
this was the peak.
But if there's one thing you can really applaud the guy for, it's that he's got great looking submissions and great technique when applying those submissions. In a world now where we have The Undertaker and Shane McMahon attempting Kimuras and guillotines and shit like that, I'm so thankful that we can have Kazushi Sakuraba here in a pro wrestling match demonstrate perfect, picture-perfect technique in executing all of his Kimuras, all of his arm bars, everything like that. It looked great.
Well, Sakuraba, he will always have that credibility with the audience. They totally buy him as legit. And they buy Nakamura as well as hanging with this guy. And yeah, again, you watch this. I wish so much that Henzo Gracie showed this match to Shane McMahon. Brother, look at the sweep. They're so beautiful.
Yeah. So, you know, the first portion of this match was really just all grappling. But then there's that one point where the slap comes in. And that's when they said, fuck this jiu-jitsu shit. Let's get into what you guys really came to see. And that's when you saw all the stiff strikes, all the knees. And from that point on, it just really became heightened to the point where even after all the knees and punches and strikes, you had a little bit of a jiu-jitsu sequence. But this time it was fast and it was aggressive and it was done in a pro wrestling style that just totally captivated me, especially as somebody just getting into grappling at the time.
I'll correct myself. I will still say in Sakuraba's run in New Japan, this to me would be the high point. But not that far off was 2 years later with Minoru Suzuki at the Tokyo Dome again. I mean, those two again told a great story. And in the right context, Kazushi Sakuraba has a place. Mm-hmm. And they use him sparingly. I mean, he's not a guy you throw into the G1 every year. But there's a placement for him among that audience. So then we go, and the next two matches are outside of New Japan, but some interesting opponents for Shinsuke Nakamura. First up we have, and these two took place within the span of a month in 2014, it is ROH War of the Worlds from Saturday, May the 17th of 2014 at the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York City. Shinsuke Nakamura against Kevin Steen, which among all these matches, I mean, these last two are the most likely that we'll see again at some point over the next year, 18 sure. months. Nakamura is the Intercontinental Champion at this point.
Unless Jan Norche makes a WWE.
Maybe they will want a giant to come in. So Nakamura's IC champion, and this was Nakamura's this tour coming in. They were doing the shows in Toronto with Global Wars and then War of the Worlds. So an audience that was primarily seeing Nakamura live for the first time. I mean, we got to see him at Global Wars prior to this.
We got to see him at the Ted Reeve Arena, and that was a little bizarre, seeing him walk out at the end of the Ted Reeve Arena in East York, Ontario.
Yes, and I remember hearing from someone there at ROH to saying, their one observation, this guy smokes like a chimney, which once Vince McMahon finds that out, good luck. So Kevin Steen comes out. Great reaction. I always love this theme music of Kevin Steen. I will always associate his entrance with this music. He comes out. He's doing Snow Angels in the streamers and very much has this vibe that was – I almost will guarantee you Sami Zayn watched this match and had it in the back of his mind because it was the same demeanor that Zayn had for the Nakamura match where he came out and it's this crowd that's in awe of Nakamura and it wasn't overt. It was very subtle, but it was very much, what's the fucking big deal? Like I'm Kevin Steen here. Like I'm the guy.
Yeah.
And that was kind of his whole entrance. That's what was exuded to me by both Steen and Zayn for the matches.
Steen always comes across to me like he's a fan of pro wrestling first and foremost. And I've no doubt was probably a big fan of Nakamura's prior to this match. And while watching his matches, I'm sure he's thinking, wow, what would I do to really make fun of this situation? You know, whether it be all the streamers for this Japanese wrestler. Well, I'm going to come in and I'm going to do Snow Angels. Or this guy's going to do his shaky thing. Well, I'm going to poke fun at that. So he really comes across to me like you're a wrestling fan who gets the opportunity to have these matches with these guys that he's watched.
Yeah, and this would be the one. I mean, this was certainly at a time where everyone knew that Steen was at least on the WWE radar at the time. And, I mean, just the thought, here we are 2 years later, that both of these guys would be in the company is something. They shake hands to start the match. They start delivering forearms. Steen falls down in the corner and stands up before Nakamura can deliver the vibration kick, the good vibrations. And instructs Nakamura to take a deep breath and then chops him. And the crowd is super hot. This was a crowd that there was no way they were not going to be pleased with whatever they had for them here. Yeah. Crowd extremely into this.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that you really should attribute, I mean, obviously to the level of the match, but also to somebody like a Kevin Steen who's able to just play with crowd reaction so much just to slow down the pace of the match and to talk to the crowd and to react to the crowd. I thought he's still great at it.
Steen pulls down the top rope and Nakamura goes down to the floor. Nakamura then sidesteps and Steen misses a cannonball coming off the apron and hits a running knee to Steen, who's draped on the apron. Carino notes that Nakamura was not a money draw until after his excursion to Mexico. Steen then comes back with a powerbomb onto the edge of the apron. Steen falls with a draping DDT inside the ring and a running senton for a two count. Misses a cannonball in the corner. And then Steen does the vibration kick, followed with a cannonball, this time that hits. Nakamura hits a running knee to the ribs as Steen is draped on the top. Goes for a guillotine into a rear naked choke and Steen escapes. Nakamura hits a backstabber, an overhead suplex, and then runs at Steen into a pop-up sit-out powerbomb for a two count. Steen falls with a Fisherman Buster suplex, can't get him pinned, and the package pile driver then gets blocked. There's a knee to the body of Steen, Beaumaier off the turnbuckle, and then a follow-up Beaumaier, and Steen kicks out at one, which you will see in the Zack Sabre Jr. match. This is Nakamura's little, this is what he gives the guy, knowing that he's going over. It's like, okay, we'll give you a kick out at one, which the first time I saw the one count kick out, I thought it was just so awesome, but it's certainly something that has been overdone.
It's a telegraph.
Yeah. And so Steen kicks out at one where it's the idea. It's his last gasp of energy. And then boom, Nakamura hits him with another. And this time he's dead. And Nakamura pins him at 12:18. I remember at the time I had very big expectations for this match and I was a little underwhelmed. Watching back, it was a good match. But I'm not going to say it was a great match, and I certainly felt the Zayn match we just watched better was better than this.
Sure. Yeah, but
but this was still good. I don't want to downgrade this.
None of these matches are bad. Okay, so it was.
It's a very high level you have when Nakamura is doing specialty matches for big shows.
Mm-hmm. But it was very hard hitting, and I thought very fun to see, you know, placing a Kevin Owens in there, having fun with sort of the mystique of the Shinsuke Nakamura character. And also a lot of fun to see Nakamura wrestle in front of this foreign crowd who treated him like a real megastar.
Just remember, this was Chaos versus KS.
Oh.
Kevin Steen.
Very nice. Cool.
So, that was, part of War of the Worlds. And our final match we are going to discuss today during our path down memory lane of Shinsuke Nakamura was his match a month later, June the 15th, for Revolution Pro out of England at York Hall, taking on Zack Sabre Jr., who will be part of the WWE Global Cruiserweight Series. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
What a time.
I know.
This was from the Summer Sizzler 2014. More shows need to have the word Sizzler in them. I'm excited just by the name.
They could take place at the Sizzler.
The Sizzler. Yeah. You could get a, you know, right by a Steak and Shake maybe.
Yeah.
Run down to the Sizzler for Shinsuke Nakamura and Zack Sabre Jr.
Yeah.
Our announcers were Oliver Bennett and Andy Boy Simmons with a Z or Z, depending upon your passport. And an incredible entrance by Nakamura. He comes out with a woman, just dips her, and is doing all his mannerisms. And this was like the entrance at NXT, where he came out, and this guy's entrance alone was like, this is incredible. This guy is just unbelievable.
The sight of him for these wrestling fans, it was enough.
The ramp could be made out of water with how they treated him walking out. I mean, it was something else.
You always hear people say, you know, the entrance is such a big part of a person's character, and it really is. This guy didn't have, you know, fancy pyro or anything like that, but it's simply the charisma that he oozes from the moment he takes his first step in that arena, whether it be just with his clothing, that red vest, that hair, and then just kind of like the weird, you know, the swag. Swagsuke, as they call him, that he comes out.
I hate that name.
Well,
or his nickname.
It's what the kids like to call it. Actually, he reminds me a lot of the rapper Danny Brown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know exactly who I'm talking about.
But tell me about both
in terms of like hairstyle, they almost have the same hair, but also in sort of their wild unpredictability. And I'm not even the first to make that comparison. You'll see like articles comparing the two of them together.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've never heard of that.
So they're very, very, both very eccentric and very unpredictable and very fun to watch.
Yeah. I mean, did you watch that promo on NXT last
week?
With
Funaki, yeah.
I mean, this guy just has such
you mean the one, the .com exclusive?
Yeah, the .com exclusive.
So, yeah. It's
just the way he's holding his neck.
So here's the thing. We'll describe it for people who haven't seen it. So it's a very typical backstage interview where Funaki or Tom Phillips or whoever asks Shinsuke Nakamura about his match, and Funaki is there to translate, and it takes place just like it plays across like any of your typical UFC interviews with a foreigner, where one person asks a very dry question, the other person takes the time to translate it. But so this happens, and then Funaki is in the middle of translating Nakamura's answer, but in the middle of the translating, Nakamura just stops Funaki. And he's just like, stop, who gives a shit? And he's just like, instead, in English, he says,
Strong Style
has arrived. And just, then does his face and then walks off. It's like,
just that, great, that thank grin you. On his face.
Thank you. You made a memorable moment out of something that could have been completely generic. And I'm sure it was very calculated on his part. He knew how stupid and silly this would have just come across had Funaki, this guy. First of all, I mean, Funaki, I'm sure he does a great job, whatever. But to associate your comedic – this guy who I think the WWE audience recognizes as a comedic character with whether it be Hideo Itami or Shinsuke Nakamura kind of makes him look silly to me, in my opinion.
I agree because – as well, I mean, he's playing a translator where his character in WWE, A, it was comedy, and B, it was like
– it brings back all those memories.
The silliest of Japanese stereotypes,
exactly.
Which is everything you're running away from with your new presentation of your Itamis and Nakamuras, and the list goes on.
So the way Nakamura just simply, you know, basically told Funaki to shut the fuck up and let me talk was great to me.
Like his charisma just – it's so unlike anyone else on that show.
And he really doesn't have to say much, you know? It's just like his limited English, make that stupid grin, and then, you know, walk off, and that's all you have to do.
I never want to see this guy hold a microphone for longer than 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ever.
Doesn't need to.
Okay, so we go into the match here. At this point, this was an interesting one politically because we had not just New Japan versus Noah, but two men holding championships with both promotions, with the IC title with Nakamura and Zack Sabre Jr., one of the junior heavyweight tag team champions with Yoshinori Ogawa at the time. So they start off with this sequence of kicks, each avoiding the other. Zack Sabre Jr. applies a rear naked choke and then transitions to a crucifix with a kick out. And Zack Sabre Jr. starts working over the left arm, moves into a Kimura. Nakamura bails to the floor and starts stalling. Nakamura then offers his hand. Sabre won't go for it, turns his back, and Nakamura attacks him. They fight on the floor. They go into the crowd, and Zack gets tossed into these chairs and drops Sabre onto a steel barricade and hits a running knee to the head. And the announcers are talking about how one-sided this is, saying, we like to use the phrase, he's wiping him out. Wiping him out. As Nakamura is controlling the match, Sabre comes back with a series of strikes in the corner, kicks off the turnbuckle, gets a two count. Then there's a flying armbar by Sabre, and Nakamura gets to the rope. Big forearm exchange, vibration kick, enziguri. Continual knees are delivered to the body of Zack Sabre Jr. And then Sabre comes back with a dragon suplex, getting a two count, and then rolls into a Kimura, which is applied by Nakamura. And
it was the same entry, the same rolling entry as a Sakuraba.
Yeah, it's applied to Nakamura, who uses a headbutt to escape the submission. Sabre then stops a Bomae attempt. They both attempt arm bars. Nakamura gets it, and Sabre gets out with a head stomp, then a running kick to the chest of Nakamura into an arm bar. The hands are clasped for Nakamura, then they're broken. He escapes and hits a Bomae. Sabre Jr. then kicks out at one. And Nakamura then misses a knee in the corner, gets kicked in the bad arm, wrenches on the arm and hand of Nakamura, who then lifts him up and he hits an Ushigoroshi and Bomae off the turnbuckle to Zack Sabre Jr. And it ends at 15-23.
The match was good. I thought Nakamura was very good, and I think Zack Sabre Jr. is technically very good. And a good match overall, though I found Zack Sabre Jr.'s charisma kind of lacking here, especially being in the same ring with Shinsuke Nakamura. I really felt he was overshadowed. And, you know, I think last time I saw him was probably the PWG show.
Right.
So I'm sure he perhaps is far greatly improved. But here I would say he didn't look nearly as confident or as open to the crowd as I expected.
Yeah, I like this match a lot. I'm a fan of Zack Sabre Jr. I thought this was better than the Steen match we watched, but certainly completely different in terms of the charisma level, the presence that Kevin Steen has, which, I mean, the guy has an incredible presence about him. So there you go. That was, you know, only a tiny look at the career of Shinsuke Nakamura. There's so much you can go back and watch of this individual, but we tried to give as wide a variety of different stuff that he's been involved with, of course, there's going to be omissions that you can go back and look at.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun watching all of these matches. And this was essentially like, you know, we're watching a full pay-per-view with Shinsuke Nakamura wrestling in every match. And
That'd be a great idea.
That was fun
Shinsuke
for me.
Shinsuke Takeover.
Yeah, sure. And it was a lot of fun to me. It was a good primer for, you know, what this man's career was. And I hope, it was educational for those of you who also haven't watched too much of him.
All right. Just a few pieces of feedback here. Christian Small writes in, Shinsuke Nakamura is the reason I got into New Japan. Around 2005, the Wrestling Channel started showing New Japan, and I saw him and Tanahashi defending the tag titles. For some reason, I really liked Nakamura. This led to me watching a match he had with Bob Sapp and more. There's just something about him that makes you want to watch more, and back then he was pretty plain and was just the super rookie. He has transformed into not only one of the most charismatic but best workers in the world, he probably has the best presentation of any wrestler going today and a great style to watch in the ring. It's as simple as just using his knees for a lot of offense, but it works so well because of how he does it. I really can't wait to see what they do with him in NXT. That debut with Sami Zayn made him look like the biggest star NXT ever signed. It was at such a level that I think you could have him face Balor for the title and it would be acceptable, much like when Owens came to NXT. Anyways, as a personal favorite of mine, I hope he does extremely well.
We got a Jesse from the Six who wanted to know why we didn't review either of his matches with Kota Ibushi.
Well, we just did back in, I think it was December or January, we reviewed the Access episode that did feature the Ibushi match from Wrestle Kingdom 9. So it's kind of redundant to review that match again right. That we had just done. And yeah, I mean, the G1 match, I didn't want to pick a whole lot of New Japan World matches, and that would be another one that's on New Japan World. So, I mean, it's an outstanding match with Nakamura and Kota. Both of them are.
He also says, what do you make of Nakamura, an obviously talented wrestler, actually reducing his moveset with his character change to the King of Strong Style? I think it's interesting that wrestlers like Cena and Reigns have been criticized for not having a varied enough arsenal, yet 90% of Nakamura's offense involves his knees. I'm not sure why it works for him, but it definitely does.
I wouldn't simplify the guy to just that particular moveset. I mean, it's very much based around that and his finish with the Bomae, but he is someone that adapts to the opponent and the situation he's in. And the Zack Sabre Jr. match was completely different from the Kazushi Sakuraba match, and I think he can vary enough of the story of the match. I mean, his matches with Tanahashi are very much different from other matches you would see with various other guys on the roster. So I wouldn't necessarily – like, yeah, he uses it a lot around his knees, but that is – to me, just overly simplifies his style.
And it's not like the knees are the same knee strike. Like, he's got a wide range of knee strikes. The Bomae can be hit from a variety of positions and angles. And I also feel like, you know, maybe as I've become a more, like, mature wrestling fan, I feel like...
A snob.
I feel, though, like... a guy's moveset and sort of the range of moveset may be a little overrated, especially if the guy's already a good wrestler. I think that, you know, timing and kind of your sense in the ring and so many other factors can make up for a lack of a moveset versus a guy with a lot of different moves, but sort of the inability to work a crowd, inability to really tell a story. I wouldn't take over somebody with a limited offense, but can be a great wrestler.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, one of the most profound statements I've read recently was before Hayabusa passed away, and he was critical of a lot of the style where it's just so heavy on the moveset, and he said
it's very video game influenced.
Yes, and yeah. I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially he was saying, you know, you do those spots, and it's not the spot that is to generate the big reaction. It's the time in between the spots that you're maximizing and getting that emotional reaction.
The selling, the facials.
Exactly. Yes. And it's – you do a lot of this and crazy move sets and introducing all this stuff in the effort to get over so that those in-betweens are so important. And once you're over, you can work a more conservative style because you're over. I mean, the Young Bucks could do 10% of what they do now because they're at this level now where they don't have to be diving every other second. But that's so much of their gimmick that they overdo everything and they don't want to subscribe to any kind of theory. And every wrestler is going to have a different philosophy on things. Mm-hmm. But Shinsuke Nakamura, and you watch him in any of his big matches, and I mean, this guy's timing and layout of matches is near the top of the industry. And that's why I also look at somebody that can do those big matches, and you don't need to be doing those every single night. Mm. Like when you go to watch an NXT live event, for instance, you shouldn't be going in anticipating some of the matches we just watched.
Did you notice from watching really what limited we have of him, really just that NXT match, did you notice much of a change in style between that NXT match and, you know, some of his New Japan work, for instance?
I mean, I don't think it was at the level of some of the big matches he had with like Tanahashi in the G1 finals or any of the Ibushi matches. But at the same time, that was a crowd that they could have come out and done 50% of what they did, and I think the reaction would have been the same.
Well, I'm curious to know just my point is like how you think his style will change, especially when he gets to the main roster.
I think that there will be maybe some pacing changes. I think that, for instance, for some of his bigger matches, you'd work it around 3 to 4 Bomaes, and maybe they'll limit that. I don't know. I don't know how they'll necessarily – maybe they believe in NXT at least that – this guy has a canvas out there and we're going to give him a lot of creative freedom, especially when he's in there with somebody experienced like a Balor or a Zane. I don't know. I don't know what their thinking will be. I'm sure there's going to be some modifications.
It'd be interesting to see him work like a 6-minute Raw match, for instance.
Main roster is a totally different beast. Yeah. I think there you would see more modifications. But even Hideo Itami, he's come in completely different from your Kenta matches. I mean, they've drastically changed him around. He's working much more of a quote-unquote WWE style, which I know some performers hate that term. But you can definitely see changes from Kenta to Itami. With Nakamura, we're going to have to see more. And we'll probably see it as he's doing a – if you're listening to this on Wednesday, he's on television tonight on NXT. And that's more of a television environment match where it's more of a showcase for this guy. And it's building to a finish in a quick amount of time. So there you go. That is our review of the Shinsuke Nakamura career retrospective. Next week, Wei, we got many requests for this and – I want to watch this. I know you want to watch it.
No, so do I. Yeah, very
so
much.
Let the cat out of the bag.
WWE Films presents Countdown.
This seems like this is the tongue-in-cheek movie project that WWE Studios hasn't done since See No Evil.
Oh, they should have.
Campy really. On purpose.
Yeah. Let me just find the synopsis. Maybe even we'll play the trailer going out.
Go for it. Yeah, let's end with the trailer.
Okay. But the general synopsis is... This movie, Jesus Christ. Okay. Countdown, originally known as 642, a madman captures a young boy and rigs... Okay, wait, here we go. Wait. Okay. Ray Thompson, a narcotics cop... Oh, this... I want to make sure that this is not... Oh, this is spoiler. Sorry. Okay, here we go. First of all...
Damn it, now we know his name.
On IMDb, this is a rating, a fantastic rating, and this only makes me more excited, of 5.1 out of 10.
Perfect.
A madman captures a young boy and rigs him with explosives. Ray Fitzpatrick, played by Dolph Ziggler, I just love how the...
Played by another fake name.
Played by another fake name, yeah. Ray Fitzpatrick, still haunted by the loss of his own son, will defy orders to stop the clock and save a life. And this all takes place in the backdrop of a WWE live event.
I wish. It's a WWE Studios movie. Why didn't they just call him Dolph Ziggler? Just so that we could have a son whose name is like Timmy Ziggler or something.
You'd be confused.
Is the madman Rusev?
No.
He's just muscle.
I think it might be... okay.
How do you not book Rusev to be the madman?
Rusev is actually starring as Rusev. We know he holds a gun. I don't know how, but somehow...
That's all I've seen is the gun scene.
Rusev the wrestler is going to have a gun backstage that he will point at Dolph Ziggler. It also stars Glenn Kane Jacobs.
I'm so excited for this.
As Lieutenant Cronin. So, we're supposed to believe that this is all going to take place in a WWE world where the WWE exists, but Dolph Ziggler and Kane do not. Instead, they play Ray Thompson and Lieutenant
Cronin. What a mind
Cronin.
Fuck.
I love it.
We're at a WWE event where Dolph Ziggler and Kane are not wrestlers. They're playing civilians.
Yeah. So I love the idea. I wish, to me, like...
The cameos in this? There must be.
Those two. I'm sure plenty of others, too. Here we go. Jimmy Uso, Jey Uso, Roman, Santino, Dean Ambrose, Kurt. Basically, the whole roster.
Dean Ambrose, huh?
Will all appear.
This is great. This is a great choice.
So
many of you requested it, so that will be our movie review next week of Countdown.
Yeah.
Available now wherever bad movies are sold.
Yeah. I think it's on iTunes. It's on whatever. Blu-ray, digital HD.
Lovely.
Check it out.
All right. So we'll finish off. We'll whet your appetite with the trailer for Countdown, and we'll chat with you next week on another edition of Review Away. And it's been our pleasure to present the preceding podcast to you, the listener.
Weird.
You are through 6 partners in 2 years. I get phone calls complaining about you, and you know what I do? I don't call them back because I don't have an answer to the question.
What question?
Why the hell are you still here?
Detective Thompson, are you there?
Can you track it?
Signal's being redirected.
Meet me at the WWE event at the Coliseum at 12 noon. A no police. I see them, he dies.
We'll have eyes on you the entire time.
Only 6 hours and 42 minutes to find him.
We have a tactical team on standby if needed. Take him now.
Freeze. You're a dead man.
We'll have officers throughout the arena.
There's a kid with a bomb strapped to him. Can anyone identify this guy?
We'll take him down.